In the first lecture, I examined the formation of political jurisprudence through the work of three innovative French political jurists, Bodin, Montesquieu, and Rousseau. My objective, of course, was not to engage in a thorough appraisal of their work. I couldn't possibly do that. It had a more limited objective. I wanted to show how their work was underpinned by a common conceptual framework. And that basic framework had been assembled by Bodin, whose account of the basic concepts of state and sovereignty established the principle of the autonomous character of the political. I then tried to demonstrate how Montesquieu and Rousseau built on those foundations of political jurisprudence that Bodin had established. The three most basic concepts of political jurisprudence, I suggested, are those of state, sovereignty, and constitution. But in the first lecture on Friday, I focused primarily on state and sovereignty because they underpin the claim to autonomy. I said very little about constitution, and this theme now arises as a result of the upheavals occasioned by the French Revolution. So I'm going to talk today about the French Revolution. Forgive me. You know more about the French Revolution than do I. In a contemporary assessment, Edmund Burke referred to the 1789 Revolution as the most astonishing event that had hitherto happened in the world. And the passage of time hasn't caused us to revise his claim. In his major three-volume study of the history of government, for example, Samuel Finer, an English political scientist, stated this: "The French Revolution is the most important single event in the entire history of government. The American Revolution pales beside it. It was an earthquake. It raised and effaced all the ancient institutions of France, undermined the foundations of all other European states, and is still sending its shockwaves throughout the rest of the world." The dramatic phase of the revolution from 1789 through to the rise of Napoleon is the critical period on which I want to focus in the lecture. During this short period of conflict and change, many of the most important elements of what I'm calling political jurisprudence were subjected to intense scrutiny. The revolutionary period provides a laboratory for considering one concept of particular significance, and that is the nature and importance of establishing a stable constitutional form. We can trace the beginning of the revolution to the moment on the 17th of June 1789, when the meeting of the Third Estate declared itself the National Assembly. The decisive motion had been drafted by Emmanuel Joseph Sieyès, and it was Sieyès who most concisely explained its implications. In his remarkable pamphlet, someone, I can't remember who, claimed it to be the most influential pamphlet ever written in the world. In his pamphlet, Qu'est-ce que le tiers-état, Sieyès argued that the moment at which the king, faced with the imminent bankruptcy of the state, had been obliged to convene a meeting of the Estates Generaux was the moment at which the constitution of the state had been placed in question. And since it was a moment of constitutional crisis, Sieyès claimed that it was inappropriate for the king simply to have convened a traditional meeting of the Estates General, one that would be organized on feudal lines. financial bankruptcy, Sieyès claimed, was symptomatic of a deeper bankruptcy of the entire political order. Rather than convene the Estates General, a constituent assembly should have been established with the objective of considering fundamental constitutional reform of the state. Prime responsibility for the dire state of affairs at that time, he argued, lay with the nobility. By virtue of their entrenched feudal privileges, the nobility had in effect seceded from the nation. Far from being active producers, they had become avaricious consumers. Far from being a vital part of the nation, they had become, in effect, its enemies. In Qu'est-ce que le tiers état, Sieyès captures the sentiment of the assembly and proclaims the third estate as the nation. In this moment, he asserts the principle of national popular sovereignty. The declaration demanded that sovereign authority be transferred from the king to the nation. The meeting of the third estate, comprising the legitimate representatives of the sovereign people, must be transformed into the National Assembly. These dramatic claims initiated a political and legal revolution. The newly established National Assembly on the 4th of August removed the privileges of the aristocracy and the clergy, leading to the abolition of feudalism and the establishment of the principle of equality before the law. The assembly then established a committee to prepare a draft constitution. As an intended preamble to the constitution, on the 26th of August, a general declaration of the rights of man and the citizen was adopted. This proclaimed, and I'm quoting in English here, that men are born and remain free and equal in rights, that the aim of political association is the preservation of the natural and imprescriptible rights of men, that sovereignty resides essentially in the nation, that law is the expression of the general will, and that without a defined separation of powers, the society has no constitution at all. Although these overarching principles of legitimate constitutional ordering owe much to Rousseau's influence, Sieyès, the principal architect of these reforms, doesn't mention him by name. Contrary to Baudin and Montesquieu, Sieyès argues that a nation is not some cultural artifact defined by laws and customs sanctioned by history. The nation has its origin in a social contract that transforms an aggregate of isolated individuals into a unified body politic possessed of a single general will. The nation comprises the entire body of citizens, and its will is sovereign. The nation, Sieyès says, is prior to all. It is the source of everything. Its will is legal. It is the law itself. The nation, therefore, remains prior to the Constitution, and its government serves only at the pleasure of the national will. It follows from Sieyès's argument that the nation is not bound by any prior constitutional order. Again, I'm quoting, a nation can neither alienate nor forbid itself the right to will. And whatever its decisions may be, it cannot lose the right to change them as soon as its interest so requires. The nation is able, then, to determine the constitutional form of the state by a pure exercise of sovereign will. In these claims and these matters, Sieyès was following Rousseau. Where he departed from Rousseau was over the formation of the national will. Rousseau had maintained that sovereignty cannot be represented, and that the moment a people gives itself representatives, it is no longer free. Sieyès argued by contrast that a constitution can only be made by its representatives, by the nation's representatives. This was required by the need for a political division of labour in advanced modern states. For Sieyès, then, the basic law, the general will, is not some ideal collective will. It is formulated by representatives as a common will. A representative body must take the place of the assembly of the entire nation and be charged with making a constitution. The bodies, that representative body's common will, he argues, is as valid as that of the nation itself. The National Assembly and its Constitution Committee, of which Sieyès was a member, becomes the sole and right and rightful bearers of the nation's sovereign will. As is well known, after August, the revolution veered out of control. The constitution was drafted in 1791, with many of its provisions bearing the marks of Sieyès's influence. Its general purpose was to put distance between the legislature, the legislative assembly, and the sovereign people, not least by dividing the citizenry into active and passive citizens. But an implicit alliance between the Jacobins and the Parisians sans culottes, who were campaigning for direct democracy and for controls over the economy, ensured that the constitution was suspended soon after it was ratified. Then comes the terror, the constitution of year three, Napoleon's coup d'etat in 1799, constitution of year seven, again mainly drafted by Sieyès, which proved irrelevant as Napoleon is named first consul and then in 1802 first consul for life, and finally in 1804 the Republic becomes an empire with Napoleon proclaimed as Emperor of France. That is a history that's more familiar to you than me, I'm sure. I don't want to get embroiled in the great intellectual debates over the revolution, but it's necessary to refer to them very briefly. For many years, the dominant interpretation of the French Revolution in France was a Marxist materialist interpretation, one represented mainly by Soboul's thesis that the revolution amounted to an economic victory of the bourgeoisie. That dominant French analysis was challenged by many Anglo-Saxon empiricists, Alfred Cobbon leading amongst them, arguing that this was predominantly a social movement and therefore one of a more complicated story than that materialist explanation implies. However, the political cultural interpretation offered by François Fouré is closest to the assumptions underpinning political jurisprudence. Fouré's argument shifted the debate over the significance of the revolution away from the social and away from the economic factors towards the political. His focus on the political as an autonomous discourse, and in particular the articulation of the political as a series of representations, resonates with the assumptions underpinning what I have been calling political jurisprudence. Fourier's work makes political culture the key object of investigation, by which he means the set of discourses or symbolic practices by which these claims are made. This notion of political culture shapes the constitutions and powers of the agencies and procedures by which contestations are resolved. It shapes competing claims to be authoritatively adjudicated, and it shapes binding decisions to be enforced. It suggests there are no political realities independent of symbolic meaning. What Fourier is saying is that the revolution ushered in a world where mental representations of power governed all actions, and where a network of signs completely dominated political life. He's asserting the autonomy of the political point of view. Of particular significance to my argument is Fourier's thesis that the revolution was driven by illusory efforts to enunciate the abstract notion of a pure people's will. In other words, it was the refusal of actors to accept Sieyès's argument about the legitimacy of representatives that led directly to the terror. The French Revolution is marked by its failure to establish a stable constitutional form. The Jacobin dictatorship and Napoleon's despotism may be different forms of tyranny, but they both stemmed ultimately from the same source, and they obeyed the same political logic. They were merely two faces of a usurpation that the principle of popular sovereignty made possible. Sieyès had recognized the problem. Although he drew a clear distinction between positive law and the fundamental constitutional law, he recognized that lurking behind both is the ultimate authority, the notion of the people as the pouvoir constituant. It is the will of the people, Sieyès recognized, that is the final law. And if this will is the will of all, it can claim a right to impose its law on all. Representation, for Sieyès, is the only safeguard. Another way of putting it is to say that institutional structures provide the safeguard. This is the argument I propose to take up by focusing on the work of one distinguished scholar of the period, Benjamin Constant. But in order to highlight the nature of this argument, I need to say something very briefly about the terror. The terror began as a series of emergency measures instituted in 1793 in response to war and to insurrection in the Vendée. These included the suspension of the Constitution in 1793, just 2 months after it had been ratified, the formation of the Committee of Public Safety, and the establishment of the Revolutionary Tribunal. There may have been many reasons of expediency for taking these actions. France was at war and under apparent threat from counter-revolutionaries. But this rapidly expanded into a system of government, which then descended into a dictatorial regime of violence and fear. Over a period of 10 months, from September 1793 to 27th of July 1794, it has been estimated that there were over 500,000 arrests and over 16,000 executions. The question for us, the question for political jurisprudence, is whether there's a link between the principles of 1789 and the terror of 1793-94. Was Burke right in predicting that the attempt to establish a political regime on a set of abstract principles divorced from social and political realities could only lead to violence and dictatorship? Was the terror a necessary element in the transition from the old feudal order to a new modern regime based on equal liberty? Was violent dictatorship needed in order to shape a new type of people receptive to the precepts of true political liberty? Is this what Rousseau meant when he said that the people must be forced to be free? The terror undoubtedly permitted the Jacobins to retain power without having gained popular support. But when dealing with the emergency, the point I want to emphasize is that they didn't simply suspend the law. They sought instead to replace one framework of legal authority with another, a different type of legal authority. They sought to replace constitutional law with a discourse of natural right. They aimed, in a sense, to put aside the precepts of what I'm calling political jurisprudence in favor of something that one might call natural jurisprudence. The most important architect of this conceptual framework was Louis-Antoine de Saint-Just. Saint-Just believed that since there can be no society that is not founded on nature, the state can accept no other laws besides those of nature. Saint-Just consequently questioned whether France even needed a formal constitution. After all, he argued, we have the Declaration of Rights, and this lays down the principles of natural right. The constitution had been suspended, but the declaration had not. The point I'm emphasizing is that for the Jacobins, the declaration provided the nation with a set of fundamental constitutional principles. It formed an eternal and invariable code, and this amounted to a true constitution. No further document was needed. In this sense, the Jacobins replaced a formal set of rules promulgated by will with a set of principles expressing right reason. And this claim to right reason meant that their ruling authority had no need of being legitimated by an expression of the will of the people through election. It found its legitimacy in adherence to the principles of liberty and equality inscribed in natural right. Nature, and not the general will, reason, not democracy, was the source of legal and political authority. On this issue, the Jacobins were not faithful followers of Rousseau. Here I'm trying to rescue Rousseau for political jurisprudence. Rousseau did not claim that political order rests on natural law. Instead, he invoked the social contract, the basic political pact that transforms a world of natural inequality into a civil order of political equality. The form of civil order established by the pact is one determined by the sovereign people as an expression of the general will, not by a vanguard who consult their own hearts and minds to reveal the dictates of natural right. Natural jurisprudence, as proclaimed by the Jacobins, maintained in the words of Saint-Just, that laws are the natural relations between things, not relative relations or the effect of the general will. Rousseau, Saint-Just explained, says that laws express the general will, and therefore a legislator is needed. But a legislature can only express nature, he says, not the general will. The Jacobins were skeptical of the claims of popular sovereignty. They uncovered the foundation of law not in the general will, but in the precepts of natural right. There's a paragraph in the text on the justification of that argument in the execution of Louis, but I'll pass over it. The Jacobins drew on a concept of natural right to anchor the legitimacy of the laws. The legitimacy of the laws underpinning the terror. And this concept triumphed over law and constitution. There are, proclaimed Saint-Just, too many laws and too few civil institutions. Only few laws are needed. Too many laws enslave the people. In place of law, we get cults, epitomized by the cult of the supreme being, the object of which is to encourage citizens to obey the dictates of natural right, which are engraved in their hearts. Under the terror, then, it's this abstract notion of natural right that provides the justification for violent oppression. The Thermidorians sought, without much success, to return the revolution to the principles of 1789. In exploring their ideas, I will focus on the work of Constant, the exemplary Thermidorian jurist. Constant is invariably regarded as a liberal. This is not wrong, but I want to look at him more precisely as a political jurist. I want to claim him for political jurisprudence. Since Fourier claimed that Constant's entire political thought turned on understanding the terror, this is where I wanted to start. Constant was certainly no conservative. He welcomed the achievements of 1789, not least because it made the break with a feudal order founded on legal and political inequality. But he was highly critical of the terror, which simply enacted a parody of liberty. In the name of liberty, he contended, we have been given prisons, scaffolds, and countless harassments. The terror did not purify citizens to render them ready for true political liberty. They made them insecure and fearful, and it could lead only to slavishness or to insurrection. And in either case, it destroys political authority. The source of this evil, Constant maintained, is to be found in the abstract claim of right. There is no despotism in the world, however inept its plans and oppressive its measures, he argued, which does not know how to plead some abstract purpose of a plausible and desirable kind. Constant was not some romantic liberal. he recognized that war is part of human nature, and that it serves the positive functions of shaping certain fine human faculties, including heroic devotion, the formation of sublime friendships, and love of country. He noted that if we trace the birth of states to their origins, this warlike criterion of friend and enemy offers a perfectly serviceable account of the formation of states. And he accepts that the governments of all states, whether despotic or liberal, have a legal, repressive, and coercive part. This is an essential aspect of government, he accepts and recognizes, since without a monopoly of the legitimate use of force, governments would be unable to ensure that citizens obey and that order is maintained. For Constant, then, the distinction between liberal and despotic government is not the absence of coercion. It's the establishment of institutional arrangements that are able to provide checks and balances in their mode of operation. Only by establishing stable institutional arrangements can authority be acquired and political power, potestas, be generated. Constant here follows Bodin in highlighting a key tenet of political jurisprudence: less is more. Restraints on power generate power. Constant is, I would suggest, a political jurist of the first rank. His great achievement was to have brought about a synthesis of the insights of Montesquieu and Rousseau. In Les Principes de Politique, he provides us with a political jurisprudence for the modern world. He accepts that the foundation of this political rests on the concepts of state and sovereignty. From Rousseau, he accepts that a regime acquires its legitimacy only from the principle of popular sovereignty. Monarchical regimes, he suggests, are invariably the product of force rather than right. But he then adds a gloss from Montesquieu, that is, that the ruling power acquires its authority not only from its legitimating source as an expression of the popular will, but also from the mode through which it is able to exercise power. Modern governments, he explains, must not only be able to claim a democratic mandate, they are obliged, they must act through accepted constitutional forms. Constant evidently believed that many of the errors of the unfolding revolution could be traced to Rousseau's teaching. Du contrat social was often invoked in favor of liberty, he says, but it became the most formidable support for all kinds of despotism. He criticized the manner in which the Jacobins misinterpreted Rousseau, not least in failing to recognize the importance that Rousseau did between sovereignty and government. This again is something that Rousseau learned from Bodin and which the Jacobins overlooked. But Constant's main message, deriving from Bodin and Montesquieu, concerned the vital importance of institutional structures. The message to be learned from the Terror is the danger of relying on abstract right to the neglect of constitutional rules. The error of the Jacobins, which again Constant claims they drew from Rousseau, is that they sought to institute a regime of political liberty in the modern state drawn from the image of liberty that flourished in the ancient world of the Greeks and Romans. They had conflated two different concepts of liberty. It was this that underpinned the terror, a period in which despotism based on fear was shrouded with the symbols and rhetoric of liberty. The rhetoric of the Jacobins was suffused with allusions to republican values of ancient Greece and Rome. But in the ancient world, no distinction could be drawn between public and private. Drawing on Montesquieu's studies, Constant highlighted the fundamental differences between ancient and modern ideas of liberty. Modern liberty is provided on individual, is founded on individual subjective right, a concept unknown in the ancient world. And it served to provide a zone of privacy, independence, security, and protection from the exercise of public power. The ancient idea of liberty was a form of collective independence from rule by foreigners. It required the active and continuing participation of citizens in the exercise of their collective power. And this was achievable only in small, compact, culturally homogeneous city-states that promoted a politics of virtue founded on a martial spirit. It was also, we might add, invariably a slave-owning warrior republic of male citizens. The ancient idea of liberty evokes freedom from external rule prior to freedom to participate in government. The brutal world outside of the city walls goes a long way to explaining the kind of liberty that was cherished by the inhabitants of the ancient republics. This was a historical necessity, one that extolled a form of liberty that was incompatible with equality. For some to be free, others had to be slaves. For Constant, the terror resulted from the attempt to instill an ancient idea of liberty in an emerging modern world founded on equality and abhorrence of slavery. He accepted the value of both concepts of liberty. I don't think Constant should be read as promoting modern against ancient ideas of liberty. But he recognized that the atrophy of the political could be as dangerous as total politicization. So I think he tried to find a balance between these two different conceptions of liberty. What he did emphasize, though, was that liberty in the modern political world must recognize the distinction between public and private, between the political and the social, between participation and independence. Political liberty, in short, presupposes civil liberty. Political liberty in the modern world involves a complicated interlocking system in which two distinct forms of liberty are mutually reinforced. So even though Rousseau acknowledged the distinction between sovereignty and government, Constant believed he had no robust theory of limitations on the exercise of governmental power. The revolution had been fueled by claims of abstract right, but it had been unable to develop a robust template for government. Sovereignty, it was claimed, had been transferred from the king to the people, but without a coherent scheme of institution building, this had operated to confer unlimited power on the new rulers of modern France, and this could lead only to terror and tyranny. Constant's ambitious objective was to try to specify the principles of political action that underpin modern constitutional regimes. So let me briefly turn to his account of government and constitution. Constant's great achievement is to have formulated an account of the nature and significance of constitutions in an era of modern government. Accepting that in the modern era the principle of popular sovereignty must prevail, he recognised that a system of government whose source rests entirely in the will of the people through election will struggle to maintain its authority. Constant believed that authority could be maintained, power, again power in terms of potestas, could be generated only by establishing an institution able to offer a representation of permanence and independence in the manner similar to the office of the king, a difficult task in the modern world to achieve. Believing that Rousseau's principle of the general will was too ephemeral, his search culminated in the notion of a neutral power that was able to mediate between governing and governed. Underpinning his thesis is the recognition that modernity founds itself on a public-private division, a division, if you like, between state and society. The autonomy of the political is a product of an emerging differentiation of societal worldviews. When civil society emerges as an autonomous domain, this does not mean that the domain of the political diminishes. That was Thomas Paine's view. The autonomy of the political and the autonomy of the civil are both parts of a collective self-division that is a distinctive feature of modernity. If that sounds abstract, it's because I took it from Marcel Gauchet. As Gauchet notes in an evaluation of Constant's work, it is misleading to speak, but I agree with him, it's misleading to speak as if there was a certain sum of power and authority to be divided, so that an increase on one side leads to a decrease on the other. The domain of the political, underpinned by an absolute concept of sovereignty, remains. But sovereignty now stands only as a representation of the autonomy of that political way of thinking. Modernity leads to a growth in both social and political power, with each drawing on one another in a reflexive process. The democratic impetus releases social power at the same time as that it produces an extension in the nature, scale, and range of governmental power. In the constitutional ordering of modern government, the top-down hierarchical ordering power diminishes, but the political continues to serve as society's symbolic underpinning, the source of its collective identity and the source of its cohesiveness. The state, Constant is pushing towards, the state organizes rather than commands. This was Constant's brilliant insight. In order to maintain its authority and legitimacy, modern government must fill the crucial function of expressing and representing society. And for this, a constitutional order of considerable institutional complexity is required. Constant noted that we must rely on methods other than election and be able to create a power other than the legislative and the executive. That is, he's searching for a symbolic neutral power that isn't purely a product of majority principle. The need for an authority independent of both the people and its representatives, the executive or the legislature, he calls a preservative power, and its purpose is to defend government against division, and to defend the governed against potential oppression by the government. So he's looking for some sense of an authority that is a neutral authority of symbolic authority of the state. This neutral power ensures that society and government can operate in harmony. Here, I think Constant identifies the modern challenge of specifying the autonomy of the political. His preservative power recognizes that political power contains an element that's not derived from delegation and mandate, that political order is in some respects prior to the will of citizens, that somehow it has its own autonomous logic. And this is realized only if the manner of its constitution is somehow recognized as being autonomous. Constant noted that this neutral power incorporates a monarchical dimension with two elements, the executive with its positive prerogatives and the royal, which is based on illusions derived from religion and tradition. Now, he may not have resolved the issue to our satisfaction, but I think he clearly recognized that once monarchy is eliminated, there remains the need to have some symbol of unity of that state that one must achieve some through some expression of symbolic representation. And inchoate though it is, that's what I think most modern constitutional orders strive to realize. To conclude then, building on the foundations of political jurisprudence laid down by Baudin, Montesquieu and Rousseau, Constant highlighted the significance of constitutional ordering to the task of building modern political authority. Such constitutions were not just the product of the will of their framers. Quoting Constant now, all the constitutions which have been given to France guarantee the liberty of the individual, and yet under the rule of these constitutions it has been constantly violated. Constitutions, he's arguing, are more than mere declarations of principles. In order to establish their authority, constitutions must be consonant with the social mores of their subjects. This theme was soon embellished by Alexis de Tocqueville. De Tocqueville elaborated two important consequences of Constant's thesis. The first concerns the role of law and lawyers in modern constitutional democracies. In this type of regime, de Tocqueville recognized, there's scarcely any political question that does not resolve itself sooner or later into a judicial question. The political discourse of modern constitutional democracies becomes infused, permeated with legal ideas and legal language. So we get a fusion of legal and political in the language of modern political authority through constitutional ordering. That's Tocqueville's first point. The second is that is what he says, something that Constant overlooked, and that is that the democratic appropriation of monarchical power is likely to lead to the bureaucratization of the state. In order to meet the needs of its subjects, de Tocqueville foresaw, the modern state would emerge as an immense tutelary power, at once regular, provident, and mild, and also absolute and minute. These two themes, legalization and bureaucratization, are the big themes I want to take up on Friday's lecture, where I'll also have to go through 200 years of history. Thank you.